Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help military veterans thrive in their civilian career. Today is episode number 250 with Navy veteran and congressional candidate Josh Welly.
This is akin to a 12 to 15 month deployment. This is 7 days a week, 15 hours a day, and you go without income. You know, one of my mentors is Seth Moulton, who's a congressman from Massachusetts, and he said, if you want to win, if you want to run for office and win, you need to do it without salary. If you want to just run, then you can keep your job. So that was a big piece.
Well, Josh left active duty after 12 years of service, which can be a really difficult decision for people in the military. In this interview, he shares a great perspective about how to approach this decision. In this interview, we talk about starting a company. We talk about politics and Josh's own run for Congress, including how he raised over $1.8 million for his campaign. We talk about viewing your life as different chapters and how to use this approach to explain your background. We talk about not having the outcome be the entirety of your focus and recognizing the things that are out of your control while still giving your all to a cause you believe in. We talk about networking, we talk about eulogy virtues, and so much more. Needless to say, there is something for everyone in today's interview. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you will find show notes. We will have a text transcript of today's interview, as well as links to every single reference that Josh talks about. You'll also find over 249 other episodes just like this to help you figure out how to succeed in your civilian career. Also, be sure to check out Beyond the Uniform's coaching program, where you can be connected with subsidized, one-on-one, professional, certified executive and career coaches to help you figure out your next career move, whatever that may be. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Josh. Joining me today on the Jersey Shore is Josh Welly. Josh, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Excited to talk.
So for listeners, wanted to give you a quick bio on Josh. He is a defense council member with the Truman National Security Project. Earlier this year, he ran as a candidate for Congress in his home state of New Jersey. He started out at the Naval Academy as part of the illustrious class of 2002, after which he served in the U.S. Navy as a surface warfare officer for over 12 years, to include missions in OIF and OEF. After leaving the military, he founded a software company with two other veterans, raised seed capital, and delivered software to the government. He holds an MA and MBA from the University of Maryland and a master's in public administration from the Harvard Kennedy School. So, Josh, maybe to kick things off, you know, the first thing that stood out from your story is you transitioned after 12 years of service. And I know that's a tough decision for a lot of listeners, of knowing, you know, at that point, whether to stay in or whether to get out. What advice do you have for listeners about how to approach that decision?
Yeah, looking back at that decision to transition, I think, you know, I would advise people to, you know, look at their lives in chapters. And to say to themselves, am I framing my, you know, my career through a lens of experiences that ultimately in the end will be a sort of a novel of great experiences? And I found, you know, in the military as a surface warfare officer, it became a bit linear for me. And I had sort of benefited from a chapter of service as a surface warfare officer, as a uniformed person, as active duty. And I was in parallel seeing, you know, classmates and friends having sort of robust experiences that I longed for. And in the military, you know, I think it gives you so many foundational skills that can be applied somewhere else, that I wanted to take some risk and, you know, put those skills to work in other, you know, ecosystems or other sectors. I also took an account, you know, this idea of family, this idea of having a career that my wife could accelerate in as well. I just got married, and I looked out ahead over the horizon, and I saw that the military wasn't going to allow opportunities for her to succeed in the way she wanted to.
I love that because it's, you know, I think our tastes and preferences change and evolve over time. Our life circumstances change over time, and I don't think there's any one right answer. So I love in your situation, it sounds like, you know, at that point in your life, it made more sense to get out, and I think it's just a great lesson for listeners to just listen to that intuition and be honest with themselves about what they're wanting and needing at whatever point in life they're at.
The other thing I'd add to that is this idea of the 10-year mark or the 15-year mark. There are friends I've known who've gotten out at 15 or 17 years to follow their passions, and they've been incredibly successful. So, you know, as people think about those milestones that are sort of a natural progression in the military, just because you did 10 years doesn't mean you should do 20. Just because you do 20 doesn't mean you should do 30. It's very contextual, and I would encourage people to keep that reserve option open. I am a reserve officer, which, you know, protects me on the retirement side. But I've had in the last, you know, 4 years since separating, I've just filled that time with so many powerful experiences that I don't regret it.
That's great. What about, could you share a little bit more about your first job search and what that was like?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, you know, if I was going to leave the sort of the protection or the umbrella, if you will, of the military, which is incredibly awesome, right? Team, great compensation, great healthcare benefits, that I wanted to take some risk. And, you know, the decision to transition from the Navy and start a venture, you know, came in those last 6 months before transitioning from the military. And I was reflecting with other vets, guys I had deployed OIF with. And, you know, we realized that we had passions and a vision to participate in, I think, this digital revolution. One of the things I think many of your listeners can appreciate is the military and government can be stagnant. It can't, it often doesn't adapt fast enough to the changing technology landscape. So my friends and I founded a company, we raised seed capital, and my first job search was as a COO and founder of a software company. I augmented that sort of decision by using the GI Bill. And at the Harvard Kennedy School, there's so much intersectionality happening now with design and business and public policy that places like Cambridge or larger universities, public universities, are doing a great job of creating intersectional education experiences. So at the Harvard Kennedy School, I studied technology and policy. I was running my software company. And I, you know, swung for the fences, you know, again, leaving the Navy after 12 plus years. If I was going to leave and forego that retirement at 20, I was going to take some big risks.
That's awesome. Do you have any advice? Because, like, to go straight from military to starting a company, I want to spend most of the time talking about the part of your career in politics, but any thoughts on just kind of starting a company directly from the military or advice about finding co-founders?
Yeah, well, first off, thanks for sort of bubbling that up. I think starting a company, especially in the technology space, or a large venture, you definitely need a great team. And I don't think I would have the confidence without that support. And the two other veteran founders had transitioned 5 to 7 years prior, and they had commercial experience. So that was essential to our success as a team. I think finding as you guys know, AngelList is a great, as many of your viewers may know, AngelList is a great resource for finding other leaders, Crunchbase, LinkedIn. I think you can get to know the ecosystem of entrepreneurs. And then be, you know, aggressive in networking. And I know you talk a lot on the podcast about the power of networking. That was a sort of an inherent skill I've had. I was the youngest of three boys growing up on the Jersey Shore, and I've had like part-time jobs since I was 10 years old. So I was always pretty scrappy. But being scrappy and resourceful and networked is incredibly important if you're going to be an entrepreneur. And ultimately, I think finding other co-founders who share that passion and a problem set that you want to solve.
That's awesome. And then, you know, what was the starting point of thinking about running for political office? Is this something you had always thought about? Was there like a particular moment when you decided, I know I need to do this? Or what was the beginning step on that path?
Yes, so I think it's important to note that, you know, leaving the military, founding a company branded CrossDeck, which is a productivity company like Slack, that journey in being part of the defense technology ecosystem, the government technology ecosystem, kept me sort of front and center with Congress and the Pentagon and the White House. And as we were developing our products and selling into the government, I never lost the passion for service. And I never lost sort of this idea of government for good. And, you know, a lot had to do with not just the president's sort of the President Trump and the phenomena that and his leadership style, which sort of defined the 2018 election. But for me, it was this idea of disruption. And, you know, what I learned in the entrepreneurial space is technology disruption. And in running for Congress, it was a continuation of with new leaders, with fresh ideas, we can make this country better. And what you saw as a byproduct of, you know, Trump's disruption, if you will, to sort of an established approach, was just a myriad and, you know, hundreds of candidates at the federal and state level answering their call to service. So for me, there is sort of a through line which brought me to run for Congress, is that I had experience in entrepreneurship and building a team and starting something from scratch. I had a deep love for government that has never sort of been there since I was a plebe at the Naval Academy. And I felt running for Congress was my chance to affect change and move the country forward. And I think so many of the candidates I met throughout the country, veterans, scientists, teachers, they all were making a career pivot into politics because of love of country.
And this is maybe a little bit of a long-winded question, but I sometimes hesitate to ask this because I don't want listeners to get this impression that there is a prescribed path to do anything, or that I think it's difficult for anyone to like look at the postmortem of their path and figure out what was helpful and what wasn't, or even to like view things as helpful for a career when there's value we get out of life. But you know, you've had a full background. You've got 3 advanced degrees. You had a long history in the military. You started a startup. I'm just wondering, like, for someone who is interested in politics, Do you have any thoughts of like which of those were pieces that you would recommend to them? Or, you know, maybe put a different way, if someone's on active duty and they want to go into politics, like, is there a disadvantage of them just going straight in before getting some other experience like you were able to do?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to answer this question. And if your viewers are really committed to elected office, I'm happy to get on a Skype call or answer emails separately. But I think where we are today as a country and moving forward is that career politicians are not well positioned to be successful. So I, you know, framed my candidacy as one of a bit of an outsider, but well qualified. And as I sort of at the outset of the conversation, you know, I'm trying to frame my career and my life's path through chapters. Each chapter serves as a building block, and each building block, creates a framework for success and service. So I wanted my voters to see myself as someone who had national security acumen, someone who had technology and entrepreneurial experience, someone who was educated and a problem solver, someone that was a doer and active in service and nonprofits. So if you looked at my trajectory, it has all these chapters that I think, when positioned either in leadership and private or public sector, make sense. So for someone who's sort of, you know, 25 or 26 and wants to get into politics, I think you can segue straight from the military, but you might want to pick something outside of government that brings sort of a mosaic of talents to bear, because the problems you need to solve in government are often at the intersection of various disciplines.
I love that. And I love your thought of chapters. I think that there's a, from a resume standpoint, there's usually like a functional resume or what's called a chronological resume. And the chronological is kind of like, you know, in order, this is what I've done. But the functional resume is where you kind of position your experience around a couple core skills. And what I think is helpful for listeners, whether you're interested in politics or not, the way that Josh explained his background, like, hey, I have this expertise in national security. It's a great way to think of whatever job you aspire to. Like, what are the three core skills? Like, when I was applying for consulting companies, it was like, okay, I need to show that I am good at analysis, that I'm good at leadership, and whatever else. And so I could tell my story and put it around those different core blocks. And so I think that's that soundbite Josh just gave you is really fantastic of thinking of how to be able to translate your story and translate it towards whatever you want to do. And I also hope that listeners take a little bit of encouragement from that view of chapters too, where it's like you don't have to get out and figure out exactly what you're going to do for the rest of your career. You can take this as chapters, you can learn, you can kind of pivot and expand, and that might be a lot more fun than just figuring it out right from the start. And so, Josh, what did you, you know, you decide that it's the time for you to kind of act on this desire. Could you walk through, like, what did the first couple of months look like?
Yeah. You know, surprisingly, and I thought a lot about, you know, mentorship in this space now, there's not a great how-to guide to running for federal office. And so I'll share through the sort of first sort of 30, 60, 90 that I went through relatively quickly. And if there's anything that pops up, please, you know, Justin, let me know.
Totally.
But look, you know, running for office, you know, starts with that conviction of service and, you know, acknowledging with your family the sacrifice that they're going about to endure. This is akin to a 12 to 15 month deployment. This is 7 days a week, 15 hours a day, and you go without income. You know, one of my mentors is Seth Moulton, who's a congressman from Massachusetts. And he said, if you want to win, if you want to run for office and win, you need to do it without salary. If you want to just run, then you can keep your job. So that was a big piece, you know, having no income for that time. And then, you know, I think there's this combination of, as I referred to, of sort of life skills and then probably sort of more management skills to get this rocket ship off the ground. And the life skills are about connecting with local leaders, mayors and councilmen, knowing the ecosystem and the political landscape of who are the big fish that you have to sort of get to know over coffee. So what I did before sort of announcing was quickly, you know, talk to the leaders in Washington and in the state of New Jersey, from the governor's not to the governor himself, but to his advisory circle. And to the brain trust of Cory Booker or Senator Menendez. I ran as a Democrat because, you know, I believe in some of those principles, but this applies for anybody running as a Republican as well. So I encourage you to do your stakeholder mapping and employ your life skills and relationship skills to start to establish yourself and make sure there's viability for your run. And then the second management piece is to the blocking and tackling of a campaign. Hiring a finance director, finding a campaign manager, office location, IT support, and then growing your team from, you know, 3 to 5 employees, ultimately to sort of, 7 to 10, and over 1,000 volunteers. So, you know, that didn't come until sort of the end of the campaign. But those were the sort of 30 to 60 to 90 that I had to do to test my viability, get the website up, get the checklist complete, and then get into the day-to-day life of a candidate.
This is fantastic. And just to set the stage, kind of what was the from the election until you started this process, like roughly how long are we talking here in terms of time?
So I took about 60 days of reflection on whether or not I was going to run. You know, we're very lucky as veterans to have some credentials. And this is in my hometown and district where I had many relationships. And then I had about 7 months of I announced in September and then had a primary in June. And then after we won the primary in June, we had the general election in November. Within that, you know, I was using management expertise and setting monthly and quarterly goals for finance, operations, and get out the and voting metrics. And, you know, those were sort of those functional skills that I brought from the military and my business background.
And I can only imagine, you know, I love what you're saying about how you're having these coffee chats, you're meeting with the brain trust, you're doing all these things. Do you have any advice for listeners of any aspiring career path of like, how did you get a hold of these people? How did you reach out? Like you must have had so many meetings in that time period. What worked well in terms of obtaining those meetings and making the most of them?
Yeah, well, I think, politically, I think what I would share is that politics is a very small, small circle of people, and it's like a small pond. And creating goodwill and trust is your currency when you're in politics. So in the fall of 2017, I was very sort of conscientious about the interests of the other people I was trying to get to know. So if they were running for office, you know, I would knock on doors for them or maybe write them a check for $50 so they could be successful. These are people running for mayor in small towns within my district. I would go to their events. I would try to build them up on social media. So, I just think it's better to give before asking if you need favors in politics. So I try to use all my goodwill and talents for their success because I knew a year from now, you know, I was going to need their help. This sort of exchange of assistance or goodwill, you know, is all for a shared purpose. So I feel like it's very honorable. And I made great friends along the way. That's how I approached it. So, and I also think the reference point is very important. And I know you in the professional space, referrals, hey, mayor of this town or church leader or activist group, this guy Welly comes approved. You should meet him for a coffee. That's very compelling as you're navigating relationships at the state and federal level.
So one, and I think that's incredible advice for just any career path. One thing that just comes to mind is so many of the guests on this show have talked about either for themselves or people that they've thought of hiring how poor a job most people from a military background do about selling themselves in an interview and networking, just in anything like recognizing their worth and being able to present that to someone. And you know what you're talking about is like it's different level. Not only you're just betting on yourself in such a big way. You're going without salary. You're putting yourself out there publicly. Like it's very intimidating for me to think about that. Do you have any advice or thoughts on like how you were able to do that, and particularly like advice for other veterans about how to do a better job advocating for themselves and selling themselves for something they believe in?
Yeah, you know, I would say the getting over the notion of, first of all, you know, humble servant, selfless leader, servant leadership does apply in politics. And all the work you do in the legislative branch or executive branch is to lift others up. So you were taught that when you were a junior officer, and you were taught that in basic training. So that skill carries forward. And I think you can ground yourself in that concept of servant leadership. And then I think for me, this idea of being under the microscope and having the courage to do that, I think that, you know, integrity is doing what's right when no one's looking. And we learned that plebe year at the Naval Academy. So I think the high standard by which we want to hold public servants, and I don't think of myself as a politician as much as a public servant or a public leader, is the idea of the public component. You know, so many of the people you're interviewing are entrepreneurs and they have online businesses and they sort of operate globally, and rarely are they put in a spotlight where every action is scrutinized. From a Facebook Live to a speech, I mean, you are under great scrutiny when you put yourself running for office. So I think if you say to yourself, hey, you know, when I was in the military, I kept my hair tight. I shined my boots. I kept my uniform within standards. There's a sort of a familiar idea. When I go out and I'm a candidate for Congress, I'm going to be my best self every day and try to, you know, lift others up in that same way. Those concepts grounded my sort of approach to being in the limelight, and it made it very comfortable for me as a veteran to do so. As it relates to selling, you know, oneself, I think you have to, it's really about ideas and issues. And for me, the message for me was to unify people at a time when we were so divided as a nation. This Republican versus Democrat stuff is for the birds. We're all Americans first, and veterans are so well positioned to tell that story of how we unite people and not divide them. And when I would listen to people over coffee and tell them my approach to service, they wanted to do more and they wanted to help.
That's awesome. And I love that message of unification. I love that message of country first. I love, I think that's a very powerful and timely message and I like what you're saying too about how well veterans are positioned for this line of work. What about could you paint a picture for listeners of what your, like, maybe just a random day in the campaign, what it looked like? And I know you kind of talked about different phases. I'm just trying to give them a sense of that gritty detail of what it was like to be in your shoes.
You know, I think the ideal day, you know, you're up at 6 o'clock or 5:30, 6 o'clock, you're getting a little PT in, you're doing your morning routine. But by 7:30, hopefully you're having coffee at a great New Jersey diner with an activist leader, a church leader, another state senator, a state assemblyman. And you're listening to them about the issues they care about and how you can weave it into your public policy platform. But you're also just making yourself, you know, approachable, and you're being out amongst the community. And then by, you know, mid-morning, after you meet your staff, you talk about the schedule for the day. It's not different than sort of imagine the captain of a ship and the executive officer and the department heads sitting around the wardroom and saying, what are the tasks of the day for the various departments? And then you sort of have to commit to often, you know, 4 to 6 hours of call time to raise capital for your venture. You know, if you think about a campaign as an entrepreneurial experience, is what I did. You know, we had operational commitments. We had a burn rate of about $45,000 a month in salary and operations costs. So we raised over $1.8 million for this campaign, almost 1.9. That's not easy at $2,700 a person, or $1,000, or $500, or $100 a person. It takes great discipline to sit down and ask people to contribute to this cause. It started off tough, but if you believe you're, you know, dialing for a better America, every dial you call and every conversation you have is for a good purpose. And I integrated software tools I used in my startup. I was very keen on being very digital and sort of data centric on my fundraising methods. And then by late afternoon, after 6 hours of call time, you go knock on doors. You'd go listen to people. So from 4 to 6 p.m. or 5 to 7, you knock on doors and encourage people to vote for you. And you're often your family or my spouse would participate in that. And then late in the evening, between 7 and 9, you're doing fundraisers. You're going to houses, house parties with 30 to 40 people. You're giving high fives and shaking hands, and you're telling your story. You know, the story of a kid who grew up on the Jersey Shore, had not a lot of money for college and went to the Naval Academy, served his country after 9/11, and wants to do more to make our country better today. And that was, you know, a pretty full day. I would often come back after that and maybe call California and try to raise capital for the campaign even more, shutting down around 2300 or 11 p.m.
That's just wild. And just to put this in context for listeners to, like, understand the magnitude of this, raising 1.8 million from individual donors. Like, I found the fundraising process for startups excruciating, and over the course of 8+ years raised $3 million in funding, but that's from like institutional investors who are doing like $1 million checks, the thought of raising that amount of money through calls and meetings and just, you know, putting your nose to the grindstone. I want to make sure listeners understand just the massive accomplishment of getting people to believe in Josh like that, and just lighting the candle at both ends, just keeping things going day in, day out. That's just requires, I imagine that requires an incredible amount of grit and determination.
I often said it was hard work, but, you know, life on a submarine or a ship, or deployed into Kandahar, you know, or Bahrain, you know, places that I was deployed, prepares you for that. Mm. And I think this idea of discipline and teamwork and perseverance is why veterans are well suited for public service. And I couldn't have done it without my team. I'm so grateful when you're on these phone calls, you know, you often have an assistant side by side, you know, you're passing phones to one another and you're closing deals online. And I hired a transgender woman for my team. And this is a woman who just has a powerful story, and she was so technically savvy, so good at data. And we were using two different software platforms we probably made 300 calls a day. Mm. And, you know, we sat, you know, 6 inches from each other, you know, 4 to 6 hours a day. And we got to know each other so well. And I couldn't have done it without her. You know, to raise that kind of money was because of her and several other great teammates on our staff who were so committed to the mission. You know, and I think about this team we put together for this campaign, and I hearken back to those, you know, great days in the 2000s on some of my best ships, and the same ethos that we created and the culture we created. I spoke to this woman after the election. I said, "How's she doing?" She said she's a little depressed. Because some of those days in the campaign were some of the best of her life, because she felt accepted. She was using her talents, and she had transitioned, you know, about 24 months prior. So I was really grateful that we hired her and that she felt happy and fulfilled at our campaign. And I just really respect that member of our team.
That's awesome. That's what high praise. That's incredible. What was life like for your wife, Angela, while you were running for Congress?
Well, as the primary breadwinner, she wasn't shy in telling me that I better win this election. She was so incredible. You know, the sacrifice that family members go through for those in politics is extreme. Again, you rarely hear the good stuff, I think, in politics. You always hear the negative about what you're doing wrong or what you could have done better. And often that sort of extends to the family or the spouse. So they have to have thick skin. But I'm really fortunate. You know, my wife just loves this country very much. She got a scholarship from Ohio State to serve in the Senate. And she was on Capitol Hill for a while. So she knew the life we were embarking upon. And she respected that path. She also has, you know, interest herself for maybe running for office. So she used this as an opportunity for her to give stump speeches and have her own schedule and address environmental, women's rights, gender equality, you know, public policy issues around climate change that she cared about. So that was pretty awesome to see her grow as a leader in this path. Not every spouse has to do that or partner has to be in the limelight like that. Mine appreciated the opportunity and wanted to be included on that strategy and execution. And I think it just made me develop so much respect for her. And then I would just also extend that, you know, just someone who just would put her needs second. You know, we went into some credit card debt along the way. No income. She knew it was for a higher calling and an important mission. And I just really respect her. This is a girl who went 10 months when I was deployed to Afghanistan, or, you know, I saw her four times in 2013 when I was in Bahrain, when we were engaged. And she just is so tough, when it comes to, supporting me and my dreams.
That's awesome. Could you share a little bit about maybe the toughest part and the most rewarding part of your run for Congress?
Yeah, I think the toughest part was when your idea of what American politics should be, you know, crashes into the realities of what American politics is. And when you experience the journey enough and you learn enough, it's kind of like imagine yourself taking a college, you know, at, you know, if physics 101, physics 201, 301. And when you get to, you know, the fourth year of physics, you've learned enough to realize how messy and difficult and challenging and frustrating it is. And I think by the end of this campaign, I truly understood the dynamics of American politics, which is, you know, which I think proves to me that it's a lot of luck. A lot of things are out of your control, and you could work 18 hours a day, 365, and not come up victorious. And I know we outworked our competitor. I know we had a great grassroots following, but that with some things in politics, with gerrymandering, money in politics, some insider stuff that happens, like, it's pretty messy. And that was a tough realization. I'm still interested in this path, but it was a tough pill to swallow at times when you, it wasn't as much your talent as it were these other external variables which shaped your success or not being successful.
And I mean, you spent time in that startup world as well. You know that too. It's just it's very true of many career paths, and it is a tough pill to swallow, the thought that you can do everything right and so much is out of your control. There's so many things, so many variables that are just out of your grasp. And that's, yeah, that resonates.
And I think when that happens, and you've probably heard before, is that you can find solace in the team. You can find solace in saying, you know what, I'm not waking up and commuting an hour to work and you know, filing TPS reports. That's the excitement of entrepreneurial paths, and very much running for politics, you know, running in for Congress is the same way. This is a startup environment, and just enjoy that freedom. Enjoy the idea that you're starting something from nothing. Enjoy the idea that you're inspiring people and transforming lives. I mean, sort of pivoting to why that tough reality is offset by great joy. Even in the 15 months of being a candidate, you know, we changed people's lives. We inspired 18 and, you know, 16, 17 and 18 year olds who were volunteers to run for office. We gave people hope in the American political system that people of integrity will run for office. You know, I don't want to be these career politicians. I was hoping to deploy to Washington, serve my country, and then move on. We also, you know, got people excited to run for office themselves. People who are volunteers on our campaign are running for mayor or council. We made gender a really important issue because of some issues in Central Jersey around the incumbent. And I think women right now are inspired to run and feel safer in the workplace. And I was honored to be a listener in that process and hopefully a fighter for those issues. So I'd share sort of the best part was being a catalyst for others to serve and also to give hope. I got to go to church on Sunday mornings and I would listen and learn from pastors and people in the congregation about real struggle, the kind of struggle we even didn't see in the military of homelessness and a drug addiction and poverty. And they look to you as a candidate to make their lives better and to feel that sense of responsibility and to be a beacon of hope for them was very humbling and very rewarding. And, you know, I recently went back to another church. There was a church in Lakewood, which was an African-American church. And I'm running against a 38-year incumbent. and I head there on a Sunday before the election, about 6 weeks prior. And the guy, and the pastor goes to me and said, "Josh, the guy you're running against has not come to this church in 38 years.
Wow.
So you're already off to a good start with me."
Hmm.
And when a pastor gives you the microphone, they're like, "You got 2 minutes." And a minute and 45 seconds, they're kicking you off the stage. Now, keep in mind, pastors have an ability to speak for 30 minutes about their most random topic, but it's their church. So, it was great. And they said to me, "We love you. You should come back after the election, or whether you win or lose." And then I came back that Sunday after the election, and it was very special to go back to that church.
Mm. I love so much of what you're saying. I know we're a little short on time, but I just love the biggest thing I take away from what you're saying is for listeners to not have the outcome of anything be the sole thing that you focus on, and just kind of recognizing what's out of your control, giving your all, and just recognizing the positive impact you have on people around you and just the person you become along the way. And that's a significant amount of the outcome. If someone is listening and they aspire to public office one day, what advice do you have for them? And is there any resources that you would recommend to them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a moment now where veterans are organizing themselves. If you go online to newpolitics.com or Arena PAC or With Honor, those are political action committees that invest and support veterans running for office. You can always go to your the party leadership, whether you're Republican or Democrat, at the township, county, or state level. There's an infrastructure in place. Some work better than others. And then I would encourage you, this is what I did not do. But if you want to run for office, try to ground yourself in a community and give yourself 18 to 36 months to establish yourself, to fill maybe a volunteer role in a committee that addresses public policy issues in your county, state, or township. And I think it would position you better to run. That would have been maybe helpful for my journey. And as I now look to sort of set the framework for maybe running for office in the future, I'm doing that now. I'm sort of digging in on local issues and staying active in the community.
And could you just share a little bit about after the election, how you figured out what to do next, and also maybe just a little bit of what's in store for you in the years ahead as it relates to politics?
Sure. I'm still in a reflection phase. What I'm grateful for is that that you can lose the election, but you can win the race. And for me, I'm racing towards a life of service and having as much impact as I can for our country and the communities that I touch. So now I have a platform from which to, one, coach and mentor people who want to run for office. So I'm also considering starting a political action committee that rewards people from other sectors who want to get into politics and mentors and coaches them. I'm also very passionate about technology and government. So I'm looking at, positions either in the private sector or in government at the state level, where we can bring cloud and cybersecurity tools to government so that, we're keeping America safe and strong. And I care deeply about economic growth and opportunity and sort of equal opportunity for all. So I think a lot of that comes from technology education and digital literacy. So those are the spaces I think I'm most prepared to serve in. For running for office, I'm passionate about federal issues, the national security landscape. So if I ran, it would likely be for national office. And that may come in 4 to 6 years. But I can tell you what, much like a startup, to embark on another campaign, I think would be infinitely easier because I've run this race already.
That's awesome. Well, what have we not talked about today that you want to make sure listeners know before we wrap up?
I think all I want to share is some things when I was at the Harvard Kennedy School, and you know why my life is sort of taking on this sort of chapters approach. And I think a lot has to do with a concept David Brooks references in a book he calls A Road to Character. And in that book, he talks about eulogy virtues. And it's a concept we didn't talk about in leadership textbooks at the Naval Academy. But eulogy virtues are these things that people say about you when you're gone. And when you left your ship or you left your command, what did people say about you when you left a company? What did people say about you? Are you a person of character? Can you be trusted? Did you help others? And I think I want to always be in a leadership position that I can exude those eulogy virtues, so that I can, you know, live a life of purpose. So I hope people see this story as running for office as a continuation of service. I think you can have impact in so many different chapters of life, but all of this is only possible because of what the Naval Academy taught me, the military taught me, and so many of those foundational principles that we learned in uniform, that I hope people take risk and be bold and know that they can do it. Because I hope that when sort of it's all said and done for me, that I can look back at all these chapters and say, you know, I gave my all and led a life of purpose. And I took risk in an effort to raise people up.
That's awesome. I think that's a great guiding post for listeners. And I just appreciate, Josh, your courage and just kind of honesty. And I just love the resolve that comes through in everything that you're saying. And excited to see what's next for you and understand the need to kind of catch a breath after all-out sprint for over a year. But very, very excited to see what you get up to next. And hopefully, if things change and you decide to run again, we can provide an update to our listeners so they can support you on the work that you're doing. Well, thank you so much for listening and for supporting Beyond the Uniform. Beyond the Uniform is produced and edited by me, Justin Asiri. Our staff is entirely part-time. They do this on nights and weekends out of the goodness of their hearts to give back to the military community. Our director of outreach is Steve Bain, who relentlessly books guests, finds sponsors, puts together our newsletter, and thousands of other critical tasks every single week, all behind the scenes to keep Beyond the Uniform running smoothly. Our editor is Kathleen Dillon, who listens to and transcribes every single episode to help out those who don't have the time to listen to the show. It has a major impact on our site's SEO value, which helps people find us through Google. Our data analytics and insights advisor is Andrew Woolridge, who pours over the data each and every month to help us better understand how to best serve the Beyond the Uniform audience. Our digital production work is done by Michael Cummings, who puts together custom artwork for every episode. If you're enjoying Beyond the Uniform, the best way to help us out is by telling your friends and fellow service members and veterans. iTunes reviews, believe it or not, have a big impact on getting the word out as well. So if you have a chance to leave a positive review, that is greatly appreciated. If you know of a business that would like to get their product or service in front of a military audience, we are always on the lookout for sponsors, which helps us subsidize the cost of putting this show together. And if you haven't yet signed up for our newsletter, you can do so at beyondtheuniform.io. We send out a newsletter twice a month, and it is a treasure trove of helpful information for your civilian career and transition. And be sure to check out our coaching program, where you can be connected with a subsidized professional, certified executive and career coach to help you in your career decision-making. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week with more stories from military veterans about their civilian career. Take care.